Good afternoon and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Mary Hughes. I'm the founder of the 2012 Project, the national nonpartisan campaign to increase the number of women running for Congress and state legislatures. I will be your chair this afternoon. It is my pleasure to introduce Gail Collins, New York Times columnist and author of As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. In 1995, Gail joined the New York Times and in 2001 became the first woman ever appointed editor of the newspaper's editorial page. She writes a biweekly op-ed column and is also known for the Conversation column she co-writes with David Brooks. Gail majored in journalism at Marquette University and received her master's degree from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She began her career in Connecticut and founded the Connecticut State News Bureau. Prior to joining the New York Times, Gail wrote for the New York Daily News, Newsday, and United Press International. She is the best-selling author of numerous books, including When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women, and the Millennium Book, co-authored with her husband, Dan Collins. Moderating today's conversation is Katrina Herron, editor-at-large, Newsweek, The Daily Beast. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Gail Collins and Katrina Herron.
We're here.
So, welcome everyone, and welcome Gail Collins to the great state of California.
Love to be here.
So we're here initially, at least, to talk about the great state of Texas. And let's begin with your description, if you would. You were just telling me in the green room that this book actually had its genesis in a column that you wrote for, as columnist, of course, for the New York Times. So tell us a little bit how this whole thing came into being.
Yeah, one of the I had been in Austin doing an event, and a friend of mine there was giving me demographic numbers on Texas, which just is exploding in population. And shortly after, I stumbled upon a video of Governor Perry when he was running for re-election, being interviewed by Evan Smith from the Texas Tribune. And Evan said, "Governor, about the abstinence-only sex education in the high schools, do you think we should change this some, because we have the second highest teenage pregnancy rate in the country at this point?" And Perry said, no, it's good. And Evan said, "But we also have the second highest rate of repeat teenage pregnancies in the country." And Perry, no. And Evan kept kind of poking him. And finally Perry said, "Look, abstinence works. I know it from my own personal life. Abstinence works, you know." And that was just so wonderful that I knew I wanted to go back and find out more. But in the process of that, I also realized, as I was going through the Texas stuff, I was fascinated by Texas's states' rights obsession. And I was asking myself which things that Texas did really were only Texans' business and which things tended to slosh across the borders. And when it came to teenage pregnancies and the war on family planning funding, which they've been having lately, there's virtually no public family planning funding anymore in Texas. Texas now has, as I said, the second highest birth rate. They have 26 million people, a hugely growing population, and in the future, about 10% of the incoming workforce in America will be people who were born and educated in Texas. And right now, 60% of the people being born in Texas are being born to moms whose deliveries are covered by Medicaid because they're so poor, which the federal government pays for half of. So all those things sort of added together to me to cause me to feel that we had a stake in what was happening in Texas. That if Texas is not educating its children well, if they're not doing what they can to help women avoid unwanted pregnancies, if they're teaching the most incredible sex education classes I have ever, oh my God, in the world. I mean, not since, you know, I was in Catholic girls' school in a million years ago have I heard theories about what happens when you have sex that are, one of them is when they got a video of this kid asking an educator, what will happen if I have sex before marriage? He said, well, you'll have to be prepared to die. This is what a nun told me, you know, but that was like 1957. It was not the same thing. So anyway, all these things led me to believe that there really was a lot about Texas that mattered to the rest of the country. And someone from Norton, my publisher, contacted me and said, there's a book in this, I think. And this book is about what Texas means to us. It's not an insider's view of what Texas means to Texans, which is much more profound.
Well, let me ask you, though, because you said a moment ago that if all of these things are indeed happening in Texas, it should matter to people in the rest of the country, and it should matter to the federal government. But the book actually takes a slightly different tack, which is to say that what's happening in Texas actually will profoundly influence what happens in the rest of the country, and indeed has done so for some time. As goes Texas, so goes the nation, yeah. Is your thesis. So if you could explain to us why you actually believe that that is so.
That was another event that sort of moved me. There were actually three events. The middle one was somebody sent me a headline from Dallas that said, man allegedly beaten by frozen armadillo. And I just thought... But the other one was when Rick Perry made his secession speech that you probably remember. It was in 2009. They were having Tea Party rallies every time a cow mooed in Texas. And... Perry gave one that was called his secession speech, but it was not really. He did not call for secession. He just made a really, really angry speech about the federal government to a large group of people who were waving signs that said, secede, secede. So, but I kept thinking, why are these people so angry about the federal government? When I look back on it, it seemed to me that Texas had been influencing or directing virtually every big thing that had happened in the national agenda over the last 30 years, beginning for me, well, not counting all the land wars. I mean, every land war in my lifetime, Texas president has been in charge. And, of course, the Bushes started three and ended one. So, but beyond the wars, there was the savings and loan crisis in the 80s, which started when the Reagan administration decided to rework the federal charter rules to reflect what was going on in Texas. They looked at Texas and saw, well, other SNLs are having problems, but in Texas they're making lots of money. Let's do it the way Texas is doing it. They had overlooked the fact that the Texans were cooking the books on their savings and loans. It ended up in the end costing us, I think, like $5,000 per Texan to bail out the Texas savings and loans. And can I tell one story about this? Because I have one story about the savings and loan thing. The worst of the Texas savings and loans was called Vernon Savings and Loan. And the regulators called it Vermin Savings and Loan. When the guy who was running Vermin went on trial, one of his defenses, which I had never heard of before in my life, was that it was not bribery to provide a prostitute for a bank regulator if the regulator failed to rise to the occasion. So, I mean, you can't not love the state, but...
Is that a form of abstinence, perhaps?
Yes, another form of abstinence. And then you look at the ending of the wall between commercial and investment banks, the deregulation of futures trading, and all that stuff that happened in the 90s. It was the responsibility of, you know, 1,000 people in Washington and outside of Washington had their fingers in that pie. But a really huge thumb was Senator Phil Graham of Texas, who was head of the banking committee. And I'm very fond of the memories of Phil Graham because I was one of about six people who was on the Phil Graham presidential press plane during the 3 days that he was running, I think, for president. It became apparent, I guess it was a shock to him, that people did not want a president who said things like, I do, too, have a heart. I keep it in a jar in my office. That's not... Anyway, but that there was that. And then there was No Child Left Behind, totally based. What we do with schools now and federal funding is totally based on what happened in Texas while George W. Bush was governor there, and on and on and on.
Well, there's so many issues being brought up here, and one immediate question that springs to mind is, do you suppose that Texans have a monopoly on frustration and anger at the federal government, and also do you think that they have some kind of monopoly on cronyism and corruption?
No, my God, no.
So a lot of what you're describing here seems to me to be well in evidence across the 50 states.
Yeah, they're actually more effective in many ways than many other states are. And in many ways, too, it just matters.
More effective.
In getting their things done. I mean, for instance, we don't talk about global warming much anymore except to debate about whether or not it exists. And that pushback on global warming began when we had, under Clinton and again under Obama, through the House of Representatives. And the main pushers back were Dick Armey and Tom DeLay, who were the House leaders from Texas. Texas is the largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the country. And when George W. Bush was president, he kept saying that he was reducing the rate of growth of carbon monoxide. God, I can't pronounce anything today. I'm sorry. Anyway, he said he was reducing the rate of growth of harmful chemicals into the atmosphere. And I couldn't figure out what that meant, and it's very hard if you reduce something, you understand it, but reducing the rate of growth, I couldn't quite figure out what it was he was really accomplishing. So I tried to use the analogy that if President Bush, who was very, as you know, a very big fitness buff, if when he went into office, he had gained 40 pounds in the first few months, and then announced that he was going on a fitness regimen in which he was reducing the rate of growth of his weight at the same rate that he was reducing the rate of harmful releases into the ozone layer, we would have had a 410-pound president by the end of his administration. So Texas is more effective and more intense in some ways and so much larger and growing by leaps and bounds all the time. So all those things are what makes it, I think, the most single important state in the country right now.
So despite the fact that lots of people today view the federal government and the legislative bodies as being, kind of locked in stasis and politicians operating completely, in the service of their own interests and their own state's interests, you think that Texas somehow has perfected this model and does it better than everybody else?
They do it better and larger. Also, throughout American history, we've had the real political division to me has been between the crowded places and the empty places. And if you live in a crowded place, you appreciate government because you can see it in operation every day. Government protects you from burglars. Government, makes sure the sewer pipes don't explode in your backyard. Government keeps dogs from pooping on the sidewalk. Government does all these useful things that you like. If you're in an empty place, you can't quite see what the point of government is because you take care of stuff yourself. You have a septic tank, for God's sake. Your dog can poop anywhere he wants to poop. The whole vision of government is different. This was the Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton fight a billion years ago. The difference now is that there are very few places that are legitimately empty. Nobody is going to come and tell you they've just written a book about the incredible influence of Wyoming, or even North Dakota. I mean, but Texas thinks of itself. The new thing is to think of yourself as being in an empty place when you're not, and that's the great Tea Party thought, that the government does nothing for me. The government is not helping me. The government is just in the way. The government is just restricting everything and taxing everything, and what good is it, and so on and so forth. And that's a great Texas thought, because Texas, 80% of the people in Texas, 26 million of them, live in metropolitan areas, but I swear to you, every single person in Texas thinks they're in the wide open spaces. It's because it's so big. It really is. You could just drive for hours between one metropolis and the next. And, of course, there's nobody there, but still, there's that feeling.
Yeah. Well, that does raise the question of how do people of Texas react to this book, and what sort of reactions have you gotten so far? Because you are the columnist. You are, you know, a willful polemicist to a certain degree. You take a kind of a wonderful thought, and you spin it, and there are many wonderful lines that people in this audience and our radio audience certainly are familiar with, and we'll get to some of them. But that is, you know, an 800-word column is not the same, you know, as a book. So how well do you feel that you understand Texas, and how well do Texans, if we can even characterize them as, you know, a group, as some kind of coherent group, I think that's part of the problem
this
here.
This would be the problem, the Texans
right.
would
how,
say. Yeah.
How well do you think that your book is going to be received?
So far, and it's new, the book is very new out now, the responses have ranged from a guy who called me on the phone the other day and said that if I ever set foot in Texas again, he'd stuff a rattlesnake down my throat. Which I put on one side, and on the other side, you know, got many, many calls from lovely people. Texas, the people in Texas are wonderful, and
maybe you could tell us a couple of stories about things that happened to you in the course of your reporting.
Oh,
that it really stood out for you.
Yeah, I got to say one thing that did not happen in the course of my reporting, but that I always tell people when we talk about Texas, when I'm in places like New York, and people tend to eagerly say, "Yes, Texas," they're, you know, Texas, they're selfish, and they, you know, if Newark was flooded by a hurricane, I cannot imagine that New York would as readily have taken in 200,000 refugees as Houston did after Katrina. The generosity of Texans in emergencies is really, really touching to me. They would like, when the emergency is over, for people to go home. But they're just amazing that way. And I've had lots of talks with people there who said, you know, I don't disagree with your overall point, but you're missing the subtleties, you're missing, you know, the wonderfulness of Austin, and you're missing the energy of Houston, which has a gay mayor. How can you say these things about Texas? We have a gay mayor in Houston.
Well, indeed, as you mentioned yourself in your book, I mean, LBJ was one of the great progressive presidents, right?
Yeah.
And he was Civil Rights Act, you know.
LBJ represented everything about Texas in a lot of perfect ways. I was really interested when I was down there with the Alamo and the near obsession people in Texas sometimes seem to have with the Alamo. The Alamo, when I went down and looked at it, my reaction was, A, what brave men these were, and B, what a bad plan this seemed to be, you know. I mean, they could have left and gone to help Houston fight the War of Independence, and Houston didn't want them to stay. They just got into this victory or death moment, you know, and that there's that in Texas, this taking strong, brave, courageous, sometimes suicidal stands for issues, you know, that may or may not be a good plan. And Lyndon Johnson and the Civil Rights Act, Lyndon Johnson knew the Civil Rights Act would ruin the Democratic Party in the South, and he went on and did it. I mean, it was just, to me, a beautiful example of the very best kind of Texas. Screw you all, this is the right thing to do, and I'm going to go there. On the other hand, the war in Vietnam was really one of those victory or death Alamo kind of moments. And I think, you know, that his Texasness kept him pushing in there when perhaps, you know, in the better course of valor would have been to get the hell out much earlier. So in both cases, you see sort of the good and the bad of kind of this great, incredible Texas spirit, which is amazing, by the way. Nobody else feels as intensely about their state as Texas does.
I think some people in California might beg to differ, actually.
I don't know. I've never seen a "Don't Mess with California" T-shirt. I know Californians do feel strongly about California. I come from Ohio.
And New Yorkers.
No, New Yorkers.
And people
no.
from Ohio.
No, New Yorkers.
And people from Massachusetts.
No, not true. New Yorkers feel very strongly about
and
New
North
York
Dakota.
City. But we don't really feel very strongly about New York State. I've never seen anybody say, "I'm from New York State." You know, it's a New York City kind of thing. When I was in Ohio, we did not pledge allegiance to the Ohio state flag as they do in Texas. And we did not take Ohio state history. And, you know, our governors did not make speeches regularly going, "Ohio, Ohio, Ohio." We just didn't. I mean, we were in Ohio. It was a good state. We were pleased to be there. But it wasn't, a part, intensive part of our identity, the way being a Texan is in Texas.
Well, as you know, also the history of the Alamo, and partly what's forgotten about it, is that all of that warring with Santa Ana had to do with the Mexican government wanting to federalize control over that area. And that really led, you know, the Texians, as they called themselves mm-hmm. then, to want to assert their independence. So you could say that right from the very, you know, the very, very seeds of statehood are embedded in this idea of independence and states' rights.
Yes, Texas is very, very, very conscious of the fact that it was once an independent republic for, I think, was 9 years. If you look on the Texas, if you go to the Texas Capitol, on the floor of the Capitol is this great sort of seal, you know, embedded in the floor. And in the middle of it is the flag of the Texas Republic. And then around it in little tiny circles are the other flags that Texas has had something to do with. Like there's the French flag, because for like 2 minutes there was a colony somewhere down there near Louisiana that belonged to the French. And the Confederate flag, you know, for that. And the American flag, the United States flag, is also around there in the circle there. And they talk about it all the time. And Vermont was an independent republic for 14 years, and nobody in Vermont ever mentions it. It never comes up in Vermont, really, ever. So that sense of being a separate thing is very, very intense, based on a fairly short history a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So let's jump forward politically. Explain to me why you think that with Texas helping to set the national agenda, how was it that Rick Perry burned out, flamed out, so with such astonishing rapidity?
Isn't it amazing? And you know, when I look back on it now, Rick Perry was the only one of those guys and Michelle Bachmann who conceivably could have stopped Mitt Romney. I mean, if you look at the other ones objectively, you know, that they were just never going to go anywhere nationally. And the theory of the theory of Rick Perry seemed so perfect until Rick Perry showed up. And then it was like, whoa. And I think that's partly about the Texans' introspection and their sense of insularity.
Maybe insularity. Huh?
Yeah. That he did so well in Texas that it didn't really occur to people that he wasn't up to a national campaign. And what he did in Texas, I read this very smart article in the Texas Monthly about the campaign he had with Kay Bailey Hutchinson for governor the last time around. And it said, Kay Bailey Hutchinson went around and talked about programs to make the government work better. Rick Perry went around and yelled about the evil federal government and how bad it was. And the audiences didn't like government. They were empty places audiences. They didn't want to talk about making government better. They wanted to talk about making government go away. And Rick Perry won the election. But when you're talking about running to run the federal government, it's a dicier thing to have your entire platform based on the fact that you don't like it.
Lots of questions here from the audience, lots of wonderful questions. I'm going to hop in with one that I don't know how much you like to opine about the future. I heard you also in the green room talking about how no one knows, no one mm-hmm. knows. But after all, you are someone who's supposed to have opinions about what people know or maybe what they don't know. Which candidates do you feel strongly that Mitt Romney should consider as his running mate for vice president?
Well, you know, that's one of the things I try not to abide by. Let's go over the list of candidates. You know, I think that the presumption is that he would like to not repeat the last episode in Republican politics with vice presidents and would like to have somebody very normal that will not be part of the conversation.
Define normal?
Sarah Palin would be the opposite of what I would define as normal. Somebody, you know, who looks like he could run the government, but you probably won't be thinking about much for the next 4 years.
And you said he.
Yeah, I don't think there's a woman out there right now who's seriously in contention that I know of. I think that'd be wonderful if he found one. But again, that would be an interesting thing to do, and I think that they're kind of shy about interesting things to do after the last time around. Everybody keeps saying maybe Rob Portman from Ohio, you know, that would certainly be that kind of choice. He's, you know, competent, he seems to be a nice guy, and we would never be discussing him at all during the campaign. So that would make sense to me, but I don't know.
Well, here's a question I feel sure you'll be able to answer. How many times have you referred to Mitt Romney's dog on the top of the car in your columns?
Here's the thing with Mitt Romney's dog. As you all know, back in 2007, the Boston Globe, when he was running the first time, ran this very long story in which they recounted a story that one of his sons told about driving to Canada the whole family. It was a 12-hour drive. It was very rigorously planned because Mitt Romney's a great planner, and there were certain designated rest stops, and nobody was going to stop except in a designated rest stop, so do not ask. That's it. That's the plan. We're going that way. And then the dog, Seamus the Irish Setter, was put on a crate on the roof of the car, and they took off, and Seamus, my guess is, didn't like the crate on the roof of the car. But anyway, he developed diarrhea. And the kids were going, "Ooh, Dad, gross, look at the back window." And so Romney pulled off the highway, drove right into a rest stop, jumped out of the car, grabbed the hose, hosed down the car, hosed down the dog, jumped back in the car, and took off without allowing anybody else out of the car because it was not a designated rest stop. And that was, you know, presented the story as sort of a good management. And when it came up, if Mitt Romney had said, "Look, I had 5 sons under the age of 13. I was in a void, a black void of despair. I didn't know what was happening in my life. It was so chaotic. And probably looking back, the dog on the roof was not a good plan." That would have been the end of the discussion. But he said the dog loved the fresh air. So it kind of became a thing, and I just sort of began to find it amusing to see how many times I could stick it in a column.
How many times have you?
You know, I don't know. Other people have been counting, and somebody told me last night it was 50-something that I mentioned. But I don't write columns about it. It's just sort of, it's like mentioned at some point.
Can you describe just for a moment your feeling when you discovered that he had done this? As a columnist, I imagine that's a kind of a delightful kind of treasured moment.
Oh, yeah. It was like the night that I was watching the debate. I was trying to write a column off the debate, Republican debate, which is hard because, you know, you really are writing right on deadline and you're feeling oppressed by the whole thing. And suddenly Rick Perry did that thing where he couldn't remember the third agency. He was, and it was like angels were singing, you know, in the background. It was just, wow.
How often do people come up to you and say, "I have a great column for you"?
A lot, but and
I imagine the angels are not singing when that happens.
Well, no, sometimes they are. People call me and point out things that turn out to be kind of amazing, and most of the things that I know, somebody first mentioned to me. I'm not brilliant enough to think of them myself, so I'm always grateful when people have good ideas.
So people literally say, "Did you hear the one about Mitt Romney and the dog on the roof?"
No, but people do send me things saying, "You think the dog thing is bad? Here's something else about Mitt Romney." That happens quite a bit. You know, I'm sticking with the dog, though.
So you don't feel the need then to travel incognito at, you know, dinner parties or sitting on an airplane?
No, people are pretty good about suggesting stuff for columns. And the thing about writing them is, you know, you have to go out and look at stuff. And I've looked at more of Texas disproportionately than I should. I'm really looking forward to going out and looking at other things in other states because, stuff you don't notice when you go there, it's just fascinating. I just love to travel and see. There are 9 states I've never been to, and I'm hoping that at least some of them I can get to in this election.
Well, let's talk about California.
North Dakota, really good Senate race. This could be my moment. Go ahead.
Your big break.
California, by the way, Texan government officials who, like Rick Perry, are obsessed with California.
And of course, we know about bringing the delegation.
Yes.
Gavin Newsom and the delegation from San Francisco. That was quite a big news item here in the state.
I couldn't figure that one out, I must admit. But that usually Californians do not ever mention Texas at all. It never hardly ever comes up. So I'm just trying to educate you right now, in fact, because I've noticed that all the obsession goes on one side rather than the other there.
Well, one thing that came up was Rick Perry's, I believe it's called the Texas Enterprise Fund.
Yes.
Which is a legislature-mandated fund that can be deployed at the governor's behest to help companies come to Texas to relocate. And of course, that's something that, you know, municipal and state governments have done for some time, but I gather that Rick Perry is considered to be someone who's done it, you know, quite successfully.
I think that should be unconstitutional. I really do. I mean, seriously. If you want to go and tell people that they should come to your state because the taxes are lower or because regulation is non-existent in the case of Texas, or if you want to build something, or, and it's very common, you know, for places to prepare land for companies that they want to come or something like that, then that's fine. But to go and to basically bribe a company to use taxpayer money from American taxpayers in your state to get a company, to bribe it, to move out of one state into another state, and then encouraging the other state, of course, to raise its taxpayers' money to bribe the company to stay. That seems wrong to me. That just seems, it should be, if they want to do it to France, that's fine. But it just seems unconstitutional to have bidding wars for companies between states. You're hurting all the states that way. It just, it drives me crazy. And particularly, they do love to try to bid out California companies to come to. I'm not sure how many large California companies have ever gone to Texas. I mean, starting another chain store in Texas does not, to me, count as going to Texas. But
my impression is that Silicon Valley companies have opened up campuses in Texas, but they have not moved their entire operations there. Here's an interesting question. In this electronic, data-driven day and age, why not, as Silicon Valley goes, so goes the world?
Because Silicon Valley is not that interested in, well, it certainly is interested, but not obsessively interested in imparting an entirely new ideology onto the national landscape. I mean, they basically are about business. And they're basically about technology. And I was having lunch with a high-ranking Democratic person the other day, and said to him, "I've noticed that you don't seem to have many billionaires. There seem to be a lot more Republican billionaires out there, you know, starting PACs and stuff, than Democrats." And he looked very depressed and said, "Our billionaires all want to do good works." So they're not starting crazy PACs to, you know, run lunatic ads around the country, and it's very depressing for the Democratic leadership. The focus of Silicon Valley is different than, I mean, certainly as Silicon Valley goes, many, many things in this world are going every day, and its effect on the culture and on the economy is great, but I don't know that its effect on politics is nearly as intense as, say, Texas's is. Hmm. They've been at it a lot longer, you know.
Here's a question, similar question about the digital age. There's been a lot of change in the newspaper business. I think we can agree on that. How have you adapted to the change wrought by the digital age?
The younger reporters, I feel so sorry for. When I used to go on the campaign trail with the president, you know, you'd be on a bus, you'd travel someplace, and then you'd file your story, and then you would go out and drink for 3 hours and then collapse, and then the next day you'd roll into the bus and do it again. And now, they all day long, they're, you know, blogging and Twittering and, you know, refiling and refiling, because it's an unending process. It's a much more exhausting world than it used to be for us. The biggest change for me was the degree to which you hear the voice of the readers now. When I first started at the Times, we thought we were very respectful of the readers and their opinions, and we were maniacal about factual accuracy. The Times has always been crazed on factual accuracy, but the sense of whether the readers disapproved of what you were doing, whether the readers thought you were screwing something up, the sense of feedback that you get now is almost overpowering. And that, before, we really operated in much, much, much more of a bubble than I thought we did at the time, when we were just sort of happily setting out the newspaper every day and then publishing letters to the editor, and that was pretty much it. So that you really do, it's a whole different world in every way. And, you know, for young people coming into the business, it's really, really hard for them now, but I the tools are all there for just an incredible future in which you could just do anything. Once if we can figure out the dreaded content paying for issue, anything could happen. The thing that makes me crazy right now is that we're losing so much local coverage. We're, I think, doing pretty well on the national front, but I go to so many places where there's either no paper anymore or there's some poor, pathetic little ghost of a paper trying, you know, with six people to keep going. And I thought by now you'd have in every single town, you'd have like an online newspaper with all kinds of local news and, you know, police reports and school lunch menus and then debates back and forth about the Planning and Zoning Commission or whatever, you know, things you do in local papers. And that's not really happening nearly to the degree I thought it would be by now. And it has to do with the fact that nobody's got a working pay model that seems to make sense yet. But that's my great hope. It could be incredible. I mean, people don't have enough chance to really experience democracy on the local level because nobody knows what's happening in so many places and towns.
And at the New York Times, of course, Jill Abramson is presiding as the paper's first executive editor as a woman in the history of the newspaper. And what does that augur for the future of the New York Times? And what changes, if any, have you seen as a result of having a woman at the helm?
You know, when I became editorial page editor, I could really feel at the paper that everybody was really, really happy. It had nothing to do with me whatsoever. Most of them didn't even know me. But just the idea of having a woman in that job clearly made people happy. I mean, it was just a good change. And I think the same thing, like triply over, happened when Jill got that job. You know, she's doing a great job. The news side has been doing, you know, spectacularly since she's taken over. We had all kinds of great stories. And as far as I can tell, everybody's happy down there with her management. And it's great. People ask me sometimes when I'm doing talks about women, questions about my background that are basically invitations to talk about hurdles I had to overcome and things that I suffered and rejections because I was a woman. And really, I didn't have any of that. And the reason was that women 1 second ahead of me filed all the suits and got in the faces of the editors and made all the demands and won all the agreements. And those women didn't get the advantage of it. At the Times, the women who filed the suits weren't the ones who became the editors. It was the women who came right after. And I know so many of those women, and they're not bitter. They're maybe still ticked off at the paper a little bit, but they're not bitter about what happened. They're happy and they're proud to see things like what's happened well with Jill, to see how well women are doing throughout the paper. And to me, that's the definition of a great heart, somebody who takes joy and pleasure in seeing other people get the stuff that they fought for but didn't get. And it always gives me pleasure to be able to mention that fact, because Jill and I stand on the shoulders of amazing, amazing women whose names you don't know.
And, of course, some of them we do know. Nan Robertson. Of course, Gail is referring to the sex discrimination lawsuit that was brought. It was a class action suit mm-hmm. brought by women mm-hmm. against the New York Times. And it resulted in a federal court order that I believe called for 20 years of supervision by the federal courts to see that the consent decree was being implemented?
In fact, it went away very fast. There wasn't the sense of the presence of that lawsuit was very, very short-lived because the Times did come around, and the Times did hire a lot of women who were not at the Times when the suit was filed in a lot of positions. And by the time I got there, it was just totally, completely not an issue anymore.
And what year did you come?
95.
In 95, yeah.
But there's a book coming out that Lynn Povich of Newsweek has written. It'll be out this fall if you're interested in that issue, in which she talks about the Newsweek women's suit, which was, you know, the first of the suits. And I remember being in New Haven then, and we had a little women's group of women and journalists in New Haven, and she came once and talked about that suit, and we were just like, oh my God in heaven, this is so exciting. And then instantly, the women at the New Haven Register went out and filed a suit. It was like, it was just, you know, the beginnings of those things that happened at just a few papers, really, were just so inspirational.
And of course, you yourself are the author of When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present, which was just about the turn of the millennium. That book really purported to show the enormous strides that women had made and really the way that the world has really, really changed for the better for women. I know that there was some criticism at the time that from people who felt that still there's such a long way to go, that maybe you had painted too rosy a picture, and also some criticism that women of color hadn't been adequately represented in the book.
Boy, I never heard that one at all, I must admit. I tried to go out of my way to make sure that women of color had their voice in that book, and I truly never heard that criticism.
And in fact, you told the stories of people like Ella Baker, mm-hmm. Rosa Parks, and so on. I think look, in the age of the Internet, you know, everybody can criticize, as you know. I think there were some blogs talking about, you know, I listened to Gail Collins on NPR, and you know, I'm African American. My mother worked my whole life long. I felt like she wasn't represented, you know, in Gail's discussion of the book, because she was talking about how women went into the workforce, but my mother was always there and had no choice, and so on. I guess the larger question really is, and this relates to the book that you tried to do on Texas, you really, for a columnist, you try to take on some pretty gargantuan topics and really kind of distill them in some way. I mean, it's an incredibly ambitious effort for someone who's used to writing in, you know, the art form of 800 words. Do you feel that you can, I mean, what's it like to take on that kind of gamble? And do you really feel at the end of this book or at the end of the Texas book, do you really feel like, okay, I nailed it?
No, you never feel like that. I mean, my favorite books that I wrote until now were the women books. I wrote one book called The Millennium Book. It was like, we will now go and look at the last 1,000 years. It was only like 150 pages long. It was, you know, but I was young and innocent at the time. But it's always, I don't know, history for me is always just a huge pleasure. And you know, often when I do events, people will get up and they're so depressed about, you know, whatever is happening right now, perhaps. And, you know, just, you know, they want to know if there's ever a chance it's going to get better, and are we ever going to get better government, or are we ever, you know, how could we get out of this huge hole that we're in? And if you get to read or write a lot of history, it's much more calming. I mean, I always can say, well, you should have been here in 1890. It was really bad back then. And you see how much stuff has changed. If you see, you know, the story of women in America is a complicated story with many battles still to be fought and considered, but overall, it just knocks me out. It just makes me so happy and proud to see what's happened in this country and all the amazing women who have taken part in the battle, and how, you know, and how men stood up and rallied around. And the story of men in the women's movement is, I think, untold. Just the 5 billion husbands, you know, just came home one night and the rules had changed while they were at work. And it was like, there's a meeting in the living room discussing orgasms or something, you know, and it's like, what did I do? It's not, you know. I have a friend named Steve Weissman, who used to work on the editorial board, who's married to Elizabeth Buemiller, who is now our White House correspondent, has just covered every important thing in the paper. And they had, when they were in New York, small children. And Elizabeth was given the chance to go cover the war in Kosovo, which is one of those things they do at the Times if they want to sort of take you and make you, you know, push you up. They send you off to do something really difficult. So she went for, I think, 6 months, and I saw Steve in the hallway. He looked dead. It was, and I said, what is wrong? And he said, with tragedy in his voice, my wife's in Albania and the hamster's missing. And I found out that's the story of American men that hasn't been told yet. You know, I mean, it's just, anyway, it warms my heart, this entire saga. So
I gather you've decided to leave that story for someone else to tell, though. That's not going to be your next book. Here's a question. What will you put in your book about California?
About California. This is a book about Texas, and I have to say again, it is an outsider's view of Texas. I do not would ever pretend to tell you the insider's view of what Texas means to Texans. I'm telling you what Texas means to the rest of the country. So it's a book for California. Invite me back, and I'll do California next. But I want to take the summer off first, please.
You do something with your, should we call him your bosom adversary, David Brooks.
Oh, David.
In the conversation. Him. Once a week, you do, you talk between columns. How do you actually compose those conversations, you and David?
It depends on where we are, and we go back and forth, and we have an editor who's helping us and sort of shifting it around, and then, you know, we sort of go into each other's thought and then poke something in and then go back and forth. It's really a pleasure. It's the best thing that I, well, not the best thing in the world that I get to do, but it's really just the most proportion of reward to effort. It's the most fun thing that I do. And David is just a pleasure to work with. One of my achievements when I was editorial page editor, I did hire David Brooks, and that was...
Is he sucking up to you?
He doesn't need to anymore. I think he's past that point completely. You know, when he first came on, it's not easy to be a Republican columnist at the Times. You do get a lot of pushback. And at first, when he first came on, I mean, he sort of looked for a while like somebody hit him on the head with a rock because it was just, you know, coming at him endlessly. But I think he's adapted and become so brilliant at really sort of expanding the horizons of readers without driving them nuts, which is a great trick. You know, people don't actually like to read things they don't agree with. The great trick of running any kind of an opinion section is finding ways to make people interested in stuff that they don't actually already know. And David is just a genius at that. I just really admire him so much. But all the columnists for the Times are just incredible. They're the most amazing group of people that I've ever worked with.
What are you trying most to change people's minds about right now?
The thing that I sort of like to do that I feel most rewarded if I can do is if I can explain something that people would normally not be interested in hearing about in a way that makes them interested in it. I got my start covering the Connecticut State Legislature. The proportion of people who will read anything that starts with the Connecticut State Legislature is teeny, even in Connecticut, very, 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 very small. So, you know, we used to just sit around and talk about, well, what can we do? We could write poems, we could do quizzes, and humor was the thing that worked best. And so that's sort of when I got into the business of trying to write about politics with humor. And I feel best when somebody says to me, you know, I didn't actually know this stuff, and I probably never would have read about this stuff, but because you put Mitt Romney's dog in there, I was prepared to do so.
Well, David Brooks writes in one of the Opinionator exchanges, of course, the code of the columnist dictates that my job is not to bring joy. It's to bring anger, frustration, depression, and torpor. Your reaction?
I think he was being ironic. He is so funny. That's one of the things that I really enjoyed. People, when he writes normally, I mean, he writes about very serious stuff usually, and you don't get to appreciate how really funny he is. He is a very funny guy, but I think he has more opportunity in the conversation to do that.
Well, here's actually a comment from you in another conversation. I'm not normally the sort of person who whines about how candidates are just engaging in sensational personal attacks and failing to talk about the issues. Normally, there's nothing I like more than sensational personal attacks.
Well, I was being ironic, too, but there is that moment. You know, I wrote a whole book, actually, about the scandals in American politics and what they meant. And generally, when there is a scandal, the effect of the scandal is much less on the voters than it is on the person involved. You know, I mean, we saw that most classically with the Bill Clinton Monica Lewinsky scandal. You know, voters were horrified, but when it came down to it, they did not want to change. They did not want to punish Bill Clinton and send him off. They did not want impeachment. Voters don't react to that stuff very much, but the people who are accused of it, it changes them. And I would give you some really boring examples involving Grover Cleveland if I had the time, but I will refrain out of concern and generosity of spirit from going any further.
But of course, as columnists, you know, your job, as you understand it, I guess, is partly to respond to those things that are happening in the media. So do you ever feel that you're being forced into the triviata?
No. I think you take all those things for exactly what they're worth. If a scandal involving some congressman who, you know, New York a couple of years ago, we had like four of them in one year, four lunatic sex scandals involving members of Congress. I mean, it was like Elliot Spitzer had opened some dike or something, and it all came pouring out for a while. And, you know, I wrote about them, and I tried to write about what they meant to voters. You know, what voters cared about, what they didn't care about, and what standards should be. But I hope I didn't obsess about them in an unseemly manner.
Well, here's a serious question for you. If the Supreme Court overturns the Affordable Care Act, if we get what some people have referred to as a no-Obamacare, do you think that it will help or hurt the president's reelection campaign?
Well, people have argued that it might actually help him because it will make Democrats really angry and it will cause Republicans to lose an issue. I don't know. The idea that after all this we would lose that final, that we finally managed after, you know, nearly a century of struggle to get some kind of a national health care program that we could use to both make sure people were all covered and also to control the cost of health care over the long run. The idea that that would be lost would be to me as shocking as I'm not sure which would be more important, the presidential election or that court decision. It's just, God, it would be so bad. And the thing that's been driving me crazy lately is this theory that you can somehow take all the good parts of it out and then use them, that you can tell insurance companies they have to cover pre-existing conditions, but you don't say that people have to buy insurance. It doesn't make any sense. It's like all the Republican debates, everybody jumped past the question of, well, what do you do if somebody's injured on the side of the road? Do you not take care of them? I mean, somehow, healthcare is not like buying asparagus. Healthcare is something that in any civilized country, people are going to get. And the question is only how you figure out how to pay for it and whether it's going to be a sensible, generous way or an evil, confusing, incredibly expensive way, which is what we have right now. So I'm sorry I got off the track, but it would be so bad.
Is this a column that you're writing out loud?
And somehow Mitt Romney will get into it. But I mean, everything is posed when we talk about it in these kinds of discourses as what will this mean for the presidential election? When it comes to this issue, I don't care about the presidential election. It means so much all by itself.
You've written that my biggest rule on women voters is that most of them won't, under any circumstances, support a male candidate who yells a lot.
It's true.
Romney is not a yeller. In fact, he reminds me of the guy in high school who was head of the courtesy club and danced with the unpopular girls at mixers. However, you continue, over the past few months, he's been a guy the unpopular girls at the mixer would have hidden from in the bathroom.
You know, I didn't even remember that. That's very... It is sort of true, though. Yeah, yeah.
Are you looking forward to covering the campaign? Well, continuing to cover it as it narrows now into the two?
Well, as a citizen, I balance between hoping to have somebody who will be a lot of fun to write about and hoping to have somebody who will not, you know, completely destroy. I mean, Herman Cain as a presidential candidate was just perfect in so many ways, but, you know, you didn't want to go there, and you didn't want to send the country there. Sarah Palin was certainly a pistol, but I wasn't prepared to, you know, hope that she would be, you know, one step away from the presidency just so I'd get a lot of good columns out of it. So you might argue that Mitt Romney's a pretty good balance of, you know, potential for being ridiculous and probably not, you know, completely irresponsible as a person to run for president. So I'm okay going with Mitt for the next 6 months. 6 months, it's a long time, though, boy. It's a really lot of Mitt Romney we're going to have going down the road.
So now that we are down to two, are you going to be able to cover, are you going to be covering Obama more, Mitt more? I mean, how are you going to apportion it, or do you know?
I don't know. You know, frankly, the terrible truth is that a lot of it just depends on where you can get to and what time you have and whether it's one of the nine states I've never been to yet. That would be an important variable.
Anything about Obama's dog?
You know, it's getting a little weird on that front. Somebody came up to me today, a well-known Democrat, and said the other day, and said, "Bo is such a nice dog. You should get to know Bo, because he's really nice." It's going to be an animal year. I can tell it already.
I want to ask you another serious question. Can you comment on California's new open primary ranked system? This, as you know, is where the two top contenders end up running against each other, and therefore they could and have now shown to be often from the same party.
I think this is really interesting. I mean, I went through a long period when I didn't like this kind of stuff because I really did think you wanted the parties to bring their best game, and it really is about the party so much. I mean, people usually don't know who these people are who are running for Congress, but they do know the parties and understand the party's agenda, and that's what they can vote for. And I always thought that was the better way to go, to just provide two alternatives like that. But given where we are right at this very minute, the idea that you'd have two candidates from, say, the same party in a very Democratic or very Republican district having to run against one another to win the approval of all the voters at the end, not just the primary voters, maybe that'll be a good thing, at least for a while. Maybe that will encourage people to take a broader view beyond, you know, whatever their fight is right at that moment. Maybe that will do something to put a little lid on the crazy partisanship that we have going. I never thought it was a good idea, to tell you the truth, but I'm warming up. We'll see. See who you send to us and them.
What's the most surprising thing that's happened to you over the course of the campaign, or I'll just say in the last year, that really profoundly changed your mind about something?
Most profound thing that happened, of course.
I don't know. Smacked you upside the head, as they say in Texas.
Well, I got to say, the whole Congress thing, David Brooks and I have had an ongoing fight about this forever, you know, because he's very much a bipartisan, moderate guy. And I was always of the feeling that you had two parties, they both provided a vision, the voters could vote between those two visions, and whosoever vision won, then they could carry out the vision for a while, and then if people didn't like it, they could just change, and that's the way it should go. But I'm thinking lately that I was too reliant on the structure of our government to let that happen. That works if you've got kind of a parliamentary system, maybe, like they do in England. But our system is so structured to stop things from happening that I'm thinking more and more as I go along that, you know, the two-partisan back and forth, and we'll stick to our guns and you stick to yours and we'll just beat each other up forever. The Newt Gingrich model, really. That's not suited to our system as it exists. It's not suited to the constitutional structure that we've got. So I'm less enthusiastic about strong partisan arguments than I was even a year ago.
And looking for,
We may have to, you know, just go back to the argument that you need people in the middle who can work out deals and make accommodations, and that, you know, accept that one party is won or hasn't won, but try to do something more than simply stop everything from happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop this. Thank you so
much,
Gail.
We're stopping everything from happening.
Collins.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Gail Collins, author of As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. Katrina Herron, editor-at-large, Newsweek, The Daily Beast, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.